And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
Stuart Stevens was my opposite number in the Mitt Romney campaign when I was the chief strategist for President Obama's reelection in 2012. Now he's a fellow at the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago, the author of five books, including The Last Season, A Father, A Son, and A Lifetime of College Football, a really interesting and good read about his growing up in segregationist Mississippi and the link between he and his father around the University of Mississippi football team. Highly recommend it. I sat down with Stuart the other day to talk about Donald Trump, the Republican Party, and a lot of the craziness that is dominating our news today. Stuart Stevens, 4 years ago, you and I were plotting and scheming against each other. Not personally, but we were both deep into the presidential election. Do you have withdrawal, regrets? Are you sorry you're not in the middle of this food fight?
Well, I'm sorry we lost, but I'm not sorry I'm not involved in this race. I wish Mitt Romney was running again. I think he'd be winning.
Why didn't he?
It was just a personal decision. You know, I was talking to him a lot in January. You know, usually with Mitt Romney, his on the record and off the record are the same. There's usually not a hidden agenda. I always get asked, you know, what's Mitt really saying? And usually it's pretty close to what he's saying publicly. I just don't think it felt right to him.
Think it was a mistake?
Not if it didn't feel right. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, my advice, such as it was at the time, was it's impossible in January of 2015 to calculate the politics for the primary or the general.
I think that has been thoroughly proven.
Yeah.
No one would have predicted where we are where we are today.
I said, look, you could win, you could come in last. So I don't think you can make a political decision. I think you have to make a personal decision. And, you know, the truth is what it always is in politics, is, as you know, most people lose when they run for president. It's like the Super Bowl. It's really hard to get there. And some reason to believe that 50% of the teams to get there lose. I think it just didn't, in the end of the day, didn't feel right to he and Ann. But I think were he running, he would be winning the nomination.
Interesting. Well, I'm sure that there are a lot of so-called establishment Republicans who would relish that scenario right now. I want to leave this. We're going to come back to the 2016 race because there's a lot to talk about there, including Donald Trump's little Valentine to you in the last few days. But you, for whatever reason, and we'll get to it, you've managed to get his attention because normally he just looks the other way when people say unkind things about him. But you know that you're one of those rare people who have come under attack from Donald Trump. But we'll get back to that later. But I really want to talk a little bit about your life and how you came to do what you're doing. I mean, we have somewhat parallel lives. We're about the same age. We both, we've been political consultants. We've been writers. You're what they call an extreme sports enthusiast, which means you go and do crazy, crazy ass things. And, I am an extreme sports fan, which means I sit in my study and watch a lot of games. So it's sort of similar. You probably are fitter than I am. But tell me about you're from Mississippi. I'm right. From New York City. It's different. Tell me about what life was like growing up and how you – and you grew up in an interesting time in the South, right. in the 60s. What was it like in was it in Jackson?
Jackson,
Mississippi.
Jackson,
yeah.
You know, I really grew up when I came of age, really, at the Mississippi burning years. And a lot of this book I just wrote the last season was about growing up in Mississippi. And it's really, I think, what drew me to politics, because politics then was so dramatic. You know, my family was...
Funny, because I feel the same way. I was watching this whole thing yeah. as a kid in New York, and I felt the same way.
Yeah.
It was a very vivid time. But you... I was reading about what was going on in the South. You were living.
Yeah, it you know, my family was close to a guy named William Winter, who was a Democrat, the really only Democrats then. And he kept running for office and losing. And I would work in all his races as a kid, you know, walking precincts and everything. Finally, I quit working.
But we should say he was... he was not a traditional Southern Democrat.
No,
he was a new Democrat in the South who was for integration and against the...
Well, he, you know, then everything was about race. And he, the phrase that people would use was he was good on race. And if you still talk to people, that's what they'll say. You know, William was good on race. And
what is that? First of all, what does that mean? And what did it mean to you?
It means that he wasn't... He wasn't a segregationist, and even more than that, it meant that he was willing to lose without going to the dark side. And there's a wonderful film that has just been made in the last year about William Winter that focuses on his time as governor. It was only 4 years because then governors couldn't run for re-election in Mississippi. It focuses on him getting education bills passed in Mississippi. But it really is a story of William Winter. It's called The Hardest Job.
Why were you personally attracted to him? Talk a little bit about your family and the values that you learned
from
him.
I grew up in lawyers and judges and ministers. And those Presbyterian ministers and Methodist ministers were all very much involved in the civil rights side from that perspective. My grandmother, on my father's side, was one of the co-founders of, it's just unbelievable to think that such an organization needed to exist, but was the Woman's Anti-Lynching Society.
Hmm.
My uncle, Francis, who died a couple of years ago, became a full-time civil rights lawyer. And, you know, in Jackson, I can remember vividly the night that Megger Evers was shot. Sheila Evers was one of my close friends in high school.
His
niece. And, you know, Jackson was a very small town. And, of course, the Ole Miss riots in 62 were vivid. The first scene in my book is the Ole Miss-Kentucky game in 1962, which was the Saturday night before the Sunday riots at the University of Mississippi, where... crazy Governor Ross Barnett came out at halftime and gave this speech, which basically called for insurrection against the federal government before the integration of Ole Miss with Ross Barnett.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, with James Meredith.
Yes.
One of the more extraordinary moments. I mean, my dad, we left at halftime. You know, I never really understood why.
Dad just said, let's go.
Let's go. We left.
Because he was so offended by...
Yeah. Yeah. And I can remember vividly, it's another scene in my book, when William Winter was running for governor in 1967. And this is in that documentary. There were many death threats against him. And
because he was a white man who rejected segregation.
Yeah. And, you know, he didn't have any security in those days. And it was always difficult then to know who was on the right side and who was on the wrong side. And if you go back to the killing of Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman, the three civil rights.
Yeah. Philadelphia, Mississippi.
In Philadelphia, Mississippi, you know, it appears that they were turned over to the Klan by sheriff. So it's always, who could you trust in law enforcement? Winter had a group of law enforcement types and former law enforcement types. My father had been in the FBI, who tried to help with security. And I can just remember vividly being in this high school locker room down in South Mississippi on a Friday night for a football game, and there had been this very specific threat that he would be shot if he came out and spoke. And they were urging him not to go out. It was this foggy night, and he insisted on doing it.
Did you know about that in advance?
I sort of understood what was going on.
So did you have a sense of foreboding when he came out to speak?
And his wife was crying.
Wow.
And he insisted that he would do it. He's a very tough guy, William Winter. Not a big guy, but he very tough guy. And, you know, finally they realized they couldn't talk him out of it, and one of them went out to the car and came back with this kind of bulky bulletproof vest, and he put it on under his jacket. And they went out to the car, and they came back with these long rifles, and they were putting them under their coats. And my father, who'd had a long war, in World War II, always hated guns, and he got a gun, and you know, they walked out, and it was powerful. And you know, as it turns out, there were very specific threats against Winter that night, and probably having those guys there may have saved his life. So it was very dramatic times. That's when Byron Delabecquith was tried three times. For the assassination of Medgar Evers. Hung jury each time.
Now in prison.
Later convicted and died in prison.
Died in prison, yeah.
But, you know, they tried him three times. And the DA...
He effectively lived his whole life without going to prison until the end of his life.
More than that, based on the publicity that he got, he ran for lieutenant governor. And his slogan was, I kid you not, I still have one of his posters, a straight shooter.
Yeah.
Came in fourth. And this is not that long ago.
Yeah.
The DA who did prosecute him, really did try to convict him. And he lived down the street from us. His son was my age. He's now Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in Mississippi. Was almost driven mad by his inability to get a conviction. And he later ran for governor himself and was elected governor, I think, in sort of a paroxysm of guilt by Mississippians, Bill Waller. But it's amazing to think how far Mississippi has come. It's one of the themes of my book is the role sports has played in helping Mississippi develop and forcing it. I think it's very much like rugby in South Africa. And not that, you know, we're home by any means. By any means.
Well, but yeah, let me ask you about that.
It's not that long ago.
You also lived, as I did, through this era when we were kids, where the Lyndon Johnson passed the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. And almost, and he said when he signed it, we just gave away the South. And, you know, Richard Nixon seized on this, and the South very much shifted from being a solid, sort of reliable vote for the Democratic Party into a Republican bastion. Today, you would say that the South is the base of the Republican Party, and race had a lot to do with that. And I ask you this not to be provocative, but you're a Republican. You lived through that. So reconcile that for me.
Well, you know, when I came up...
Maybe I asked it to be provocative. I don't know.
No, you know, when I came up, the Democrats were the segregationist, the Eastland and Stennis.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really formed by that. And to be a Democrat was sort of to join that machine.
Mm-hmm.
And unless you wanted to be like a county clerk in Itawamba County, there was no joy in being for the home team.
That wasn't your aspiration.
Yes. And we're all sort of formed by that early experience. And so it was guys like Thad Cochran who came along to beat the Eastland machine, which they thought never could be done. And, you know, Charles Evers endorsed Thad Cochran. And
Medgar's brother.
Medgar's brother. And so that's how I was formed. And, you know, I think once you sort of start that path, it's where you end up. You know, I'm very critical of both parties.
Makes you the average American, probably.
Probably to a fault, which gets to why I'm in this fight with Donald Trump. I think there's plenty of fault to go around, and it would be Mississippi is an example of a place of great imperfections that having at one time not too long ago it had more African-American elected officials than any other state, not per capita. And it's obviously changed a lot. But, you know, there's still a dark side there. And we saw some of it in this Thad Cochran primary.
Yeah, he had a very vigorous primary with a Tea Party candidate. And my recollection is that was sort of suffused in the background was sort of race and...
It was very complicated. You know, I worked for Thad, and it was one of those things, because I had worked in Thad's earlier races, I went down...
How long has he been in the U.S. Senate now?
Thad was elected in 78.
Yeah, so a long time, which was probably part of the problem.
It was not a great year to be running... And, you know, last year was not a great year to be running as a longtime incumbent for anybody.
Yeah, but beyond that, I mean, you know, he was really depicted. I mean, his record is quite conservative in the Senate. He was depicted as kind of a leftist by the opposition. And, I mean, this is sort of the battle that's going on within the Republican Party right now. It seems like your party is in a kind of civil war.
Yeah, you know, there's sort of two narratives, to use a word I hate, but...
You're a writer, man. Narratives, isn't that what you do?
Well, but it's just the way it's used now, but people get it, so I'll use it. There's sort of two narratives about the Republican Party. One is that it's all, homogeneous, all sort of boring white men, and everybody thinks alike. The other is that the party's so diverse that it's a civil war and no one can get along.
Or there's a third interpretation, which is... It's all a bunch of white guys, but they're in a civil war.
I think they're all true. And it's like, I think at any given moment, it's all true. You know, I tend to think conflict is good. I'm drawn to conflict because I think when people are arguing, that's a good thing. I think when people start to agree too much, it's a bad thing. I think the party has gotten in many ways bigger. If you just look around the country, you know, if 31 governorships or something like that, you're going to have a lot of different visions of what that country ought to be, of what that governorships ought to be. There's a lot of arguing. I think that's good. You know, a lot of it I don't agree with. I mean, if you look at the McDaniel Cochran, I mean, that was a flat-out street fight. I mean, I went down there for 3 days to help out, and I stayed for 7 weeks. And, I mean, we fought it out in this. I mean, it was...
Yeah, it was a brawl.
It was a brawl. I mean, it was a flat-out rumble. And it was ugly in a way that we hadn't had ugly in Mississippi in a long, long time, and I didn't think we would be. But, you know, the good guy won.
Barely. I mean, with a runoff.
It was a runoff, and he did what people thought couldn't be done, which came back in a runoff, and more people voted in the runoff than in the previous, which we didn't think would ever happen.
Well, do me a favor. Describe to me, as someone who's, I confess, not a Republican, describe to me what the camps are in the Republican Party. How would you describe the camps in the Republican Party right now?
Well, I think, to me, the two biggest splits are, there's this, I would call, a Ted Cruz, Donald Trump category that believes that the reason Mitt Romney lost is because he didn't get enough conservative white votes, and that you can just drill down more in there and win. And then there's another.
He did better among white voters than anybody probably since Reagan, right?
Well, we can get to that theory and the validity of it. Then the other is that the party needs to expand, and that it needs to be.
Doesn't it? I mean, the country is becoming more diverse all the time.
Well, let's just sort of look at each of these real quick.
Okay.
So Romney got a higher percentage of white votes than Ronald Reagan did in 1980. So to me, it's sort of like you've got a baseball team. You got one guy who's hitting 450 and a bunch of 125 hitters. You want to raise the average. Could you get the 450 hitter to 600? Yeah, you could in theory, but maybe it'd be better to get the 125 guys to hit their body weight. That'd be like more logical. I don't think you're going to have a candidate that is going to.
I almost slid into a Chris Christie joke, and I didn't.
Yes.
So go ahead.
Okay, good.
Though he would be an all-star. Go ahead.
Yes. I think on all sorts of levels. One, I think as a party, you have a moral obligation to represent the whole country, and that forgetting any other electoral needs, you need to represent the whole country. We need to do much better with African Americans, which has been the great conundrum of the Republican Party for a long time, and we need to do better with Hispanics. And forget the electoral element, just as the Democratic Party can't become a minority white party. It needs to do better. It needs to pass up. The Democratic Party can't become a party of the coast that only wins every 4 years, that doesn't have any governors in the middle of the country. That's bad for the political dialogue of the country.
I mean, part of the reason that is true is that most of the governors are elected in midterm elections when the turnout is radically different.
Which
than
is
it
bad.
Is. Yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah, which is bad to have that difference in turnout. It's bad to have people that disengaged. You know, you should have more of a leveling. And when you do, you have better governance. And you look at the states that have less of a drop-off, they tend to be better governed states.
So you think we should do more to encourage people to vote? Make it easier for them to vote?
I think we should.
Because some folks in your party don't feel that way.
I think we should. I'm sort of a radical on this. I'm open to crazy stuff they do, like, you know, mandatory voting and you get fined. And where I break down is when we say, oh, Ohio reduced early voting, and this is a sign that they're doing voter suppression, and yet New York doesn't have any early voting. So if we really believe that the test of voter suppression is early voting, the logical conclusion is we will focus first on states that have no early voting. That would be the states like New York that have no early voting. So I get sort of my little spider, moral spider.
I agree. We should have early voting everywhere. So, I agree with that.
And if you really believe that, and you're a senator from New York like Hillary Clinton, your own state doesn't have early voting. So let's fix that first before we start worrying about a state that, you know, maybe doesn't have enough early voting. Zero is the ultimate. So it starts to get where the moral outrage becomes a bit transparently political. And
do you think there are states where there's been an effort to, I don't want to get deeply into this, but where there are, you coming from the South and the experience that you've had, are there states where there's been an effort to try and discourage minority participation in elections?
I don't see that. I'll be honest. You look at Mississippi, we had voter ID for the first time. And if you look at the Cochran race, the complaint was that African-Americans were voting at a higher level than they ever had before.
Well, you guys actively solicited African-American votes, didn't you?
I don't know how to answer that. We tried to get people to vote for us. You know, we don't have party registration in Mississippi. Mm-hmm. So we asked,
I don't think it's a bad thing.
We asked people to vote for us. And that whole conundrum, what was so...
But that was what was striking about it. It was like that was... You were... reaching out to the minority community, and that was being held up in that election by the other side as a very, very pernicious and negative thing.
Well, it was even worse than that, because what they were saying is you're trying to get Democrats to vote for you. So when you don't have party registration and you're saying you're trying to get Democrats, what are you really talking about? Mm-hmm. And in that race... you had these predominantly African-American precincts, say, take South Jackson. The previous election had been 6 years earlier. If you go back to the general election, when Barack Obama was on the ballot, you know, you go in these precincts in Jackson and you'd look at them and you'd have, say, you know, box 21. I know these precincts like the back of my hand. Megar Ebersole precinct. Barack Obama would get like 1,400 votes. Thad Cochran was on the ballot. He would get like, you know, 200 votes. So in the primary, in the runoff, he would get maybe 82 votes. So it was not some miracle that these people were voting for Thad Cochran. It was not some gimmick. Most of them were repeat customers. And since the whole message that was being delivered was that we were going to pick our senator in this election... The idea here...
Because you know, no Democrat was going to get elected.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The idea that 50 years after Freedom Summer, these people wanted to participate in the selection of the United States
Senator.
I know. I know, but I mean, the whole idea was...
It does say something, though, that was considered sort of heresy that you would go and see
African-American
votes.
I was out there screaming from the battlements to go out to try to get... people to vote for you, and that to call these people to say that you were trying to get Democrat votes and that was illegal or something when we don't have voter registration was racist. I was screaming that from the battlements. We all know what we're talking about, and it's wrong.
Let me before we get into the I'll ask you about it now, and then we can circle back to 2012. So your buddy Donald Trump tweeted last night, Stuart Stevens is a dumb guy who fails at virtually everything he touches. Romney campaign, his book, etc. Why does Anderson Cooper put him on? So you definitely got his attention. What did you do to so disturb the Donald?
I spent like 5 minutes on Anderson Cooper predicting, not for the first time, that he was going to lose Iowa, which he is. And that he won't be the nominee, which he's not going to be. I said
months ago. I said he was going to have a great summer as people got serious. His vote would diminish. Party would coalesce around someone else. You know, it's January, and he's still doing pretty well. And he's doing pretty well, honestly, Stuart, with a very nativist, strident message. First of all, why? And secondly, what gives you confidence that he's not going to ultimately prevail?
It's clearly wishful thinking. I think whenever we be it politics, sports, or finance, whenever we find ourselves saying, "Well, this time it's different," it turns out not to be different. You know, when it's 1999 and we say the NASDAQ's going to go to, you know, 10,000, Pets.com's going to take over the world, well, it doesn't. housing prices are never going to go down. Well, they do. Donald Trump is at his essence an absurd human being. And I think it's always easier to predict the outcome of these things and the timing of these things. It's like looking at a sports team that fundamentally isn't very good. Maybe they can have a run, but you know they're going to get beaten by a better team ultimately in a long season. I think that he has a certain appeal. He's a candidate of anger. We have a country that is 23% of the people think we're going in the right direction. There has been, we're in the period of the greatest inequality in American history. The last 7 years have been fantastic years if you owned assets. The stock market is booming. People who were doing well are doing better. The rich have gotten richer. The poor have gotten poorer. And most people feel that there are these large, powerful forces in their lives that have influence on them, and they don't know what to do about it. And we've had other periods like this in American life, and it led to great religious movements or great populist movements. I mean, we were talking about this earlier. I think that he is very manipulative. I think that he believes in absolutely nothing. He's someone who's changed parties 5 times, which is, you know, more than he's changed wives. And he's able to manipulate that. And there's certain appeal to that. But I think that...
He's leading. He's been leading now for 5 months.
You know, I have to remember...
I mean, with the
2000,
immigrant, you know, immigrant trade, obviously, a big point for him. The refugee, barring Muslims from the country and so on. I mean, he's found a market for all of that, and it's a fairly large market.
He's selling hate. And there's always a certain market for hate. And I think ultimately... it's a loser's market there.
So tell me something. Why has there not been a serious campaign against him? Why have all the candidates navigated around him? Your firm, I know you're walled off from it, but your firm represents Governor Christie.
Right.
Donald Trump says thousands of people in New Jersey were cheering. Muslims in New Jersey were cheering when the towers went down. It was really, he maligned the state of New Jersey and the people who lived there. Why didn't Chris Christie say, that's a load of crap?
I think a couple of things. One, I think each of these candidates, it's been a very crowded field. And each of the candidates has struggled to try to, in their few minutes on stage in these debates, tried to tell their own story. And most of them have had very limited resources to try to tell this story. And if you've been someone like Chris Christie, you've been governor, you've been a prosecutor, you're up there on stage, you have to ask yourself, am I going to talk about prosecuting organized crime, cutting taxes, doing this? Or am I going to start getting in a food fight with Donald Trump in these precious moments? It's always, you know, Sophie's choice. You've been up there. And it's very difficult. You're 3 people down the state, you know, on camera. You're not one-on-one with the guy. It's a very difficult.
But on the other hand, isn't it test of strength whether you stand up to the obvious – center of attention on the stage who's spouting a bunch of
I think each of these candidates is in a different place physically on stage and a different place in their candidacy at a different moment. I think that the obvious person who was standing next to him, who has been directly insulted by him, was Jeb Bush. I think that Jeb has the largest resources. I think Jeb now is stepping up to do this more. I think he should have done it sooner. I think he probably regrets that he didn't
gone
after Trump sooner. I am baffled why his PAC hasn't done it. Jeb now himself is doing it more. I would expect in this debate you're going to see it more. You're going to have a smaller field.
As we have this conversation, we're a day before another Republican debate in South Carolina. Yeah.
But I think there's two approaches to Donald Trump here. One is that, as Marco Rubio said, you know, as a candidate, you could spend all day responding to Donald Trump. You're then letting Donald Trump drive the race. You have to talk about why you want to be president of the United States, which is something that Barack Obama has done when he was a candidate, did very well. You know, you have to put your vision out there. You have to talk about, ultimately, no one on that stage is running because Donald Trump is running. They'd be running anyway. And it's sort of a black hole you can get sucked into. You know, as you know better than anybody, David, presidential choices every day is about deciding what is important and what is critical.
What about all these guys with the billions of dollars who are running third-party organizations, you know, 501c4s, super PACs of their own, all these gazillionaires who purport to be disturbed about Trump? Why have they been silent?
There's not that many. Again, the... By far, the largest accumulation is in this Right to Rise pack.
The
Jeb Bush pack. I think, you know, they spent like $50, $60 million. I think had they spent $50 or $60 million contrasting Jeb Bush with Donald Trump, it would be a Jeb Bush-Donald Trump race. I think Jeb Bush would be winning that race. I don't understand why they haven't done this. Jeb Bush would be better off if they had. I think that Donald Trump is a like a zeppelin floating overhead, this large, slow moving, hydrogen filled thing, just waiting for people to start poking. What? And he is incredibly thin skinned. I would object that he's just reacting to me. He reacts to everything.
No, I know. I was joking before.
Yeah. Oh,
it was
okay.
It was an attempt at irony. I should have.
Now he reacts to.
Said, I'm going to attempt irony here.
If he was president, a 12-year-old kid in Moscow in his basement could start a nuclear war. I mean, you've never had a candidate who was so ripe for negative attacks just because he'll respond to everything.
Let me ask you one question based on the conversation we had a little bit earlier, though. As someone who grew up in an environment in which the politics of hate was so apparent, how do you interpret the Trump movement?
Well, I think there's a Trump emotion, and if Trump starts winning and became a nominee, I think you can call it a movement. You know,
how do you feel about it personally?
I'm personally deeply offended by it, and it's one of the reasons that I speak out about it because I feel sort of almost a moral obligation to. I think that what Donald Trump says and has come to stand for is despicable, and I feel an obligation to stand up to it. I don't think Donald Trump believes in anything. And I think that if he thought that he could get a rise out of a crowd, he'd be up there with a hammer and a sickle in a second. It'd be to the barricades. I felt the same way about Chris McDaniel, that if Trotskyites were in power, you know, he would be up there, you know, singing the International. But it's still hateful. And I think you have to stand up to it.
What does it mean for – what has all this done to the Republican Party?
I think you have to wait and see. I think ultimately there's two ways to look at it. When someone runs and is defeated, you can say, okay, that's the opposite of validation. That's a rejection. So if we all agree that if Donald Trump wins, it means something. So I think it's only fair to say if he loses, it means something. You have to let voters speak. I mean, that seems to me that that's a process. And there's been a tremendous rush to say that Donald Trump doing well means X, Y, and Z. I think we have to wait and let voters decide.
Would you support him if he were the nominee?
Oh, God, no. Not in a million years.
Do you think that is going to be common among some Republicans?
Oh, I think if Donald Trump were the nominee, which I don't think he will be, there'd be a very strong third-party candidate.
Let's talk about 2012 for a second.
Yeah.
Because you talk, and I believe that when you run for president, you got to speak to the whole country.
Yep.
And I said, we had Mitt Romney on this podcast, and I've had wonderful interactions with him, and I've gotten to know him since the election, and I like him personally. I like him. But, you know, one of the signature events, or one of the benchmarks, or one of the, I don't know what you want to call it, but one of the events that really defined the race in 2012 was this tape that leaked, the 47% tape, that really seemed to divide the country in half between, you know, people who seemed to be depicted as sort of strivers and people who weren't, who were takers. You know, what did Paul Ryan say, makers and takers? What was your reaction when you saw that tape?
Well, listen, I don't think it was, as Mitt has said, I don't think it was well said. I think it was an example of a candidate trying to play political consultant, which never turns out well. I was actually at that event, but I wasn't in the room. And I think someone asked a question, and he was responding to that question. I'd never heard him, and I was with him a lot, voice that particular phrasing before. You know, that
You must have had the same reaction. I mean, when I saw it, I said, holy smokes, this is a huge problem.
You know, I don't think that it was decisive at all in the election. There's no data that would show that. You've been through these things, be it religion and guns, or
I've lived through it.
Yeah, you know, the Reverend Wright stuff. You know, the election was pretty stable, as you guys have pointed out since then.
Did you think, by the way, did you think that you guys were poised to win on election day? There's been a lot about that, you know.
Yeah, I don't know where that. Listen, we were never ahead in our numbers. Our numbers were always very good. Now, it's difficult to talk about Hurricane Sandy, because then people always say, well, do you think you would have won without Hurricane Sandy? And there's no universe that exists without Hurricane Sandy. But in my experience, every time you beat an incumbent, you always had to be on the offense at the end. It's like an NBA game. You had to control the ball at the end. Hurricane Sandy greatly took away the ability to control that ball at the end.
It also knocked. I mean, if the race, if Obama was ahead, I mean, my view of that was it really knocked the election out of the headlines, and so it was very hard to move
the number. Exactly. You know? Now, that's not to say if you hadn't had Hurricane Sandy that on that next Thursday, you know, Thursday before the election, that Mitt Romney wouldn't have gone out and made some terrible mistake. We could have lost by more. It just froze the election. We went from having big sweeping rallies around the country to sitting in hotel rooms. If you look at the exit polls, 16% of the people cite Hurricane Sandy as the number one reason they voted for Barack Obama. I thought that we were moving to a way where we had the ability to possibly win at the end, which is all you can ask for, I think, when you're running against an incumbent president of the United States. I was well aware of the fact that no incumbent president who was not in the federal funding system, which did, as it was intended to, level the playing field, had lost in the last 125 years. And that was Hoover. He had a bad year. It's very
not
hard.
As bad as The American people.
As it's very hard to beat an incumbent president of the United States. And the money does not help. And I'm a great proponent of the federal funding system. It's a sort of separate conversation.
Yeah.
So I thought that we had a shot, and then Hurricane Sandy came, and it was just sort of flatlined. But I was never particularly hopeful. You know, this idea that, you know, Mitt thought he was going to win. You know, every candidate and every top athlete, all to perform at the level, at that level, they always have to have confidence. If you ask Peyton Manning in the last quarter of the Super Bowl against Seattle when they were behind, 20 points, if they were going to win, I think he would have looked at you like you were crazy. Of course they were going to win. I mean, you can't go out and perform at that level and think you're going to lose. It's an absolute impossibility. And much was made kind of off these reporters on the plane. Mitt written a concession speech. I've never known a candidate while they were campaigning who wrote a concession speech. I mean, I wouldn't let a candidate take time from campaigning to write a concession speech. What an absurd waste of time. The campaign had two speeches. One of the things about Mitt Romney, he's very analytical. After every debate, he's one of these guys, he only wanted to talk about what he had done wrong. Not, this was beautiful, baby. It was always, this just didn't feel right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if this had gone two more questions, I don't know what I would have said. He's very self-critical. It's one of the reasons he's been so successful. He doesn't need a lot of praise. If you look at the film Mitt,
it's a good movie. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, we start getting numbers from Virginia, and he's like, that's bad for Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
That's immediately where his mind goes. If we're not winning well in Virginia.
So, I don't think that the outcome necessarily would have been different. But do you think that the things that you had to do to win the primary made it more difficult to win the general election, where he had to run to the right on immigration and some other issues that obviously, I mean, he got 27% of the Hispanic vote. You worked on George W. Bush's campaigns. Yeah. He got 44% of that vote in 2004.
Well, let's talk about that. So in the summer of 2011, before the primary, the generic Republican was getting 27%. Romney got 27%. So at face value, the primary didn't hurt the Republican. It just didn't help. So people say, the primary hurt. Not really. But it was a squandered opportunity to help, would be an accurate way to depict it. All of this stuff about self-deport, that was a phrase that he used once. It never penetrated. If you actually go back, sort of ironically, and look at what he was saying, it was actually in opposition to forced deportation, that he was expressing a sentiment for self-deportation. It was kind of an unfortunate phrasing. But it was actually, if you read it, it was, we shouldn't be deporting a lot of people. We should let them self-deport. As you know, the Obamacare was always most popular with Hispanics from the very beginning. And the majority of the Obama campaign's advertising to Hispanics was about Obamacare.
No, it wasn't about immigration.
It wasn't about
education. It was about Obamacare.
Obamacare. And there's some reason to believe that Obama was for Obamacare and Romney was against it. So in that era.
Although the second part is one we could have a debate about, because Romney did, I think, really good work in Massachusetts that Obama drew on. I mean, now that the thing is over, I think Romney deserves credit for what he did in Massachusetts. It was a good thing to do.
Oh, and mass health care.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't. This whole notion that has always struck me as absolutely absurd, that you could craft a state government plan, and because it worked there, it therefore meant that it would work for the country. Under that same philosophy, if you support the governor of New Hampshire, believes that
that the only national tax plan should be no sales tax, and that we should have no income tax.
Well, should we redo Medicare and let every state have their version of Medicare?
I think it's different. It's obviously different because you craft a individual plan to meet a specific need that Massachusetts, which is a wildly different economic environment than most states, had. So they addressed it. That doesn't mean that...
Truth is, he had a very moderate record in Massachusetts on a number of things, on the environment, on health care. I don't know. It seems to me that he had to deal with a party that was more conservative than he on a bunch of stuff, and that was a challenge.
Hey, listen, you know, Romney, I think what's interesting, if you go back and look at it, you know, what do we know about this Republican Party? It's increasingly Southern, even, as you pointed out, you know,
evangelical
and populist. What do we know about Mitt Romney? And he won a primary. And, you know, won 45 primaries and caucuses. I think it's been a while since someone without an obvious geographic or ideological base did as well as he did. Maybe Bill Clinton? I have to think about it.
But can the Republican Party win nationally as a white Southern evangelical party if that's the sort of core and that's where the candidates have to pitch their appeal?
Well, no. I mean, just as a matter of numbers, obviously not. You have to do better. You know, you have to win Ohio. You know, you're going to have to win New Hampshire. You're going to have to win suburbs of Virginia, which have become very different.
So Trump and Cruz seem to be. Cruz looks like he's going to win Iowa. Can he put that coalition together? There are the Trump folks, no. The Cruz folks are among those who are saying if we just get more white folks to vote, white conservatives to vote, we can win.
Yeah, they're wrong. You know, when Cruz and Mitt Romney were both on the ballot in Texas, Mitt Romney got more votes. Even though Mitt Romney didn't spend a dime in Texas,
who do you think there's a candidate running now?
Yeah, I think I think of those candidates, I think that I think Chris Christie could win. I think Jeb Bush could win. I think that Rubio could win, and I think Kasich could win. And I think they could even win easily, particularly against Hillary Clinton. I mean, Hillary Clinton is a very, very damaged candidate. I just find it extraordinary that the party would nominate Hillary Clinton. You know, you've never had an incumbent president followed, in modern times, followed by a member of their own party of an older generation. Now, we don't pass the flag backwards. Now, it could happen. I mean, things happen that haven't happened. But I tend to think it hasn't happened.
I guess it depends on whether people feel like the party itself is passing the flag backwards.
Right. That's right. I agree.
That's the danger for the Republican Party. If the party nominates a Trump or a Cruz and...
We'll lose overwhelmingly.
But what does it mean in terms of the future of the Republican Party?
Oh, I think it'll be like a Goldwater scenario where, you know, it'll be...
Could it split in two, or do you think...
No, I don't buy those things, you know. Mm-hmm. But I'm not enough of a political scientist to be able to, you know, argue why it should or wouldn't. I just tend to think that it won't because there won't be enough energy for it to happen. I think, you know... it'll just be an ass kicking, and then they'll regroup.
But
they'll
if a third party Senate, grows, that could lose. Be. The, if a third party come happens, that could.
I don't think that would. I don't think if it was Cruz, there'd be a third party. Mm-hmm. I think you'd just get your ass kicked. You'd lose the Senate. You know, there's only one state that Romney lost where we won a tight Senate race, and that was Nevada, and he only won by 0.03. But you know, if you look at these Senate races.
You've got a bunch of Republicans up Illinois, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Ohio, New Hampshire, Ohio, Florida. You have an open seat.
You got to have a presidential candidate who's doing well, or you're going to lose them all. So, just ask yourself. I mean, if Hillary Clinton is winning Ohio at 53 points, I mean, it's already tough in Pennsylvania, and Florida is never an easy day. I did the last Republican Republican Senate race in a presidential year, Mel Martinez, and with George Bush winning, it was still a long slog to get Mel up there. I did Tom Ridge in Pennsylvania. It's hard. You know, you put Ted Cruz up there and, you know, it's just going to be.
So let me just finish where we started in a way and ask you, given your experiences as a young man, what's your hope for the Republican Party in the future?
Well, look, I think the last 7 years have not been good years. I think that they have been, if you just look at the numbers, you know, they have been years of, for the first time, we have a middle class that is smaller than the wealthy and the poor. And we have fewer people working and making less money. And the country is less hopeful. And we can argue why, and we can argue.
We
can argue it was inevitable.
I think we've got a long-term problem.
We do,
and it's been brewing for decades, which is the changes in the economy and what that's meant for the middle class, what it's meant for upward mobility. That transcends any parties. I just have to say a word because I need to live with myself. I can't let you say that and not recognize the fact that
all long-term
that
trends.
Obama took office, the quarter before he took office, the economy was declining by 8.9%. We were losing in the month he took office 800,000 jobs. We've had 70 straight months of job creation now. He's going to end up creating 10 times as many jobs as the last administration did. So, yes, I think we've got a big problem with wages, with mobility, with polarization in the economy. And it's one that demands both parties to pitch in and discuss.
Here's what I worry about the most. Republicans have never been very good at speaking for those left behind. And what I see is that there has been a muting of voices for those who normally speak for those left behind and a desire not to speak up for Republicans and not to criticize President Obama these last 7 years. And that
who's not been criticizing President Obama?
That
certainly not Republicans.
No, that those who normally would speak up for those who have been left behind, mm-hmm. who are the most vulnerable.
You mean within the Republican Party?
No, within our nation.
Oh,
I mean just our national voices. You know, be it from the New York Times to just those that are more center left. Their voices have tended to been muted these last 7 years and have not spoken up about the poverty enough, have not spoken up about those that are being left behind and dropping out of the middle class because of a fear that they're a concern that it would be supporting Republicans and hurting President Obama. And we have, I think, been poorer because of a lack of those voices. And Republicans aren't very good at it. And what I worry about is a sense of accepting what is happening now as positive. This idea that, to use a phrase, new normal. And we don't have a John Steinbeck now. We have a John Stewart. You know, this is multimillionaire, clever social critic from New Jersey. But he's not someone who speaks to this economic pain. And we have these two pockets of vast, vast wealth in America, D.C. and Manhattan, where so much of the national conversation is driven, that we've lost this this connection. You know, we don't have a Studs Terkel anymore. We don't have these voices. And that, to me, is a something that has been lost. Part of it is that we don't have as many regional newspapers that we used to have. And so what I would hope for the Republican Party, to get back to this, is that it can begin to somehow speak for those that have been still out there, that and connect with them in a way. This is the future of politics in America, those who are doing okay but not great but still want to do better. And whoever can reach those people is the party that's going to, I think, dominate. And we've been much better.
And reach them not with divisive messages.
Exactly. Not with hate. Because ultimately, hate is exhausting and burns itself out. And it's a downward spiral. And we've been better at that on the local level. We've been better on that on the state level for a lot of reasons. And we just have to find the right people and be able to do it better on a national level. Or we'll keep losing elections.
Stuart Stevens, author of The Last Season, great book. Everyone should pick it up, about his formative years in Mississippi, his relationship with his dad, and author of many other books, author of many campaigns, and a guy who once skied 100 miles to the North Pole, I'm told. And you don't find many who fit that same description. So thanks for being here. Thanks for being a fellow at the Institute of Politics.
It's a real, real pleasure, man. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files. For more podcasts like this, subscribe to The Axe Files on iTunes. And for more programming from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, visit politics.uchicago.edu.